Hello and welcome once again to Adventures in Theater History. This week we have what we call a special episode because it is not strictly my own work. Instead, it's going to be me reading directly from one of my favorite Philadelphia history books, Wicked Philadelphia, Sin in the City of Brotherly Love by Thomas H. Keels, published by the History Press in 2010. And, as you'll hear, our friendly neighborhood sound designer, Chris Colucci, has added in extra music and sound effects, so I think between the two of us, we've done a lot to bring this great story to life as a podcast presentation. Thomas H. Keels is a lecturer, writer, and historian, specializing in Philadelphia history and architecture. In addition to Wicked Philadelphia, he has also written Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, Philadelphia Graveyards and Cemeteries, Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square, and Sesqui, Greed, Graft, and the Forgotten World's Fair of 1926. In addition, Tom has been a tour guide at Laurel Hill Cemetery, Philadelphia's premier Victorian necropolis, for over two decades now. I was introduced to Tom by Joe Lex, who does the great podcast All Bones Considered, which covers the stories of all the fascinating people who ended up being interred either at Laurel Hill or West Laurel Hill cemeteries. I recommend you check out both Tom's books and Joe's podcasts, and that if you're in Philadelphia, you add that to the list of things to do. Taking a cemetery tour among the marble mausoleums with either of those gentlemen, they're really cool guys. In his book, Wicked Philadelphia, Keels covers many of the seamier sides of Philly history, including prostitution, murder, fraud, and in fact, there is a very fine chapter on the strange story of how the body of the actor John Barrymore finally came home to its final resting place in Philadelphia, something I hope to cover in a future bonus episode for our supporters on Patreon. Tom has very generously agreed to let me use the text of his book today, and I'm very grateful to him for his kindness as well as for his deep scholarship and excellent writing. The chapter I am reading today is called Oh, It's a Lovely War, The Mischianza, 1778. So, although we've been making forays from the 19th century into the 20th century in some of our episodes lately, this story shifts back and forth between the 19th century and the 18th century, the Revolutionary War period, in fact, an era we haven't really covered since about episode 4. The story isn't about plays that were staged in theaters, it's about a grand pageant staged by British soldiers. So it falls rather under the broad category of paratheatrical activity, along with our previous exploration about circuses and parades. It's all part of the larger story of performance traditions and public display in Philadelphia, and it has also been examined by many theater historians as one of the earliest examples, a blackface portrayal in the city of Philadelphia. And before we move on to the 20th century, in the months ahead, I thought we should go back and cover it. All right, once again, these are all Thomas Keels' words. I love this chapter so much, I couldn't possibly improve on either his research or his writing, but I hope you'll enjoy our rendition of Oh, It's a Lovely War, The Mischianza. On November 26, 1896, the social event of the Philadelphia season took place at Horticultural Hall, an elegant Italian palazzo next to the Academy of Music on South Broad Street. The cream of society gathered under the ballroom's coffered ceiling for the Mischianza Ball, named after a gala thrown by British officers for the city's belles during the American Revolution. The ball was the highlight of a four-day charity event that included, among its numerous attractions, a Wild West post office run by dainty debutantes in frontier attire, a play by the Mask and Wig Club of the University of Pennsylvania, and a Zodiac booth where Miss C. Delaney Belt foretold the future.
Prince Louis of Savoy, grandson of King Victor Emanuele II of Italy, and guest of honor, arrived at the ball at 10:30 p.m. He was mobbed by would-be Cinderellas, who swarmed around the tall, handsome prince like bees on a honeycomb. Louis was rescued by Mrs. Edward Willing, glittering in her diamond tiara and necklace, for the grand march around the ballroom to inaugurate the evening. Behind the prince and Mrs. Willing came Mayor Charles F. Warwick, escorting Mrs. S. Weir Mitchell, wife of the renowned physician and author. They were followed by the ball's other patronesses and managers, members of Philadelphia's most aristocratic families, bearing names like Biddle, Cadwallader, and Wharton. After the grand march, couples took their places for a carefully choreographed quadrille. Young Samuel Chu II, dressed in a powdered wig and satin knee breeches, escorted his sister Bessie, Elizabeth Oswald Chu, resplendent in her 18th century silk ball gown, onto the dance floor. As the orchestra played, the handsome young couple gracefully executed an intricate minuet. Sam and Bessie were the youngest generation of a family that traced its American roots back to the 17th century. Their ancestors included Benjamin Chu, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the Province of Pennsylvania from 1775 to 1777. Since Benjamin's day, the Chus had lived at Cliveden, the colonial country house that still bore scars from the Battle of Germantown, fought in October 1777. Tonight, Sam II was playing the role of John Andre, the British officer who had masterminded the original Miss Chianza in May 1778. Bessie was impersonating her ancestor Margaret Peggy Chu, Benjamin's daughter and Andre's supposed sweetheart. As the couple concluded their dance, the audience applauded, enchanted by their youthful beauty and aristocratic grace. None of the guests was gauche enough to mention that American patriots had cheered in 1780 when John Andre was hanged as a British spy, or had cursed Peggy Chu as a treasonous harlot for consorting with the enemy. The original Miss Chianza of May 1778 was the British Army's swan song after a seven-month occupation of Philadelphia that had not only proved to be expensive and pointless, but also had given its shattered enemy time to recover. No military force has ever celebrated its own ineptitude or acknowledged its own defeat with as much splendor and panache as the British Army in the sunny spring of 1778. When the British captured Philadelphia on September 26, 1777, they thought they had pierced the heart of the American rebellion. The city was the birthplace of the Declaration of Independence, seat of the Continental Congress, and de facto capital of the United Colonies. They didn't realize that, unlike a traditional European power, the decentralized American government would not crumble once its capital was conquered. Congress quickly reassembled at York, and General Washington moved his forces to Valley Forge after the Battle of Germantown. While American troops and civilians suffered through the bitter winter of 1777-78, the British hunkered down in relative luxury in Philadelphia. General Sir William Howe, Commander-in-Chief of the British Army in North America, occupied the mansion of former Governor Richard Penn on Market Street below 6th, later rebuilt as the President's House. Hessian Commander Wilhelm von Kneiphausen claimed the John Cadwallader House on 2nd Street. Their officers commandeered other mansions, often displacing the owners to make room for their mistresses. Common soldiers had to be content with the almshouse, from which 200 destitute adults and children were evicted in November 1777. Many of them later died from starvation and exposure. Viewing himself as a peace ambassador, Howe reached out to Philadelphia's upper classes during these dark days with receptions and parties. His officers entertained proper Philadelphians with plays at the Southwark Theater and balls at Smith's Tavern. By diverting the elite, Howe hoped to win their hearts and minds, convincing them that they had stronger ties to the English aristocracy than to the noisy rabble demanding independence. Young ladies of quality, even those who called themselves patriots, soon succumbed to the endless line of dashing young officers in well-cut red jackets. Their parents usually supported the girls' fraternization. Many upper-class Philadelphians were staunch loyalists who viewed the signers of the Declaration of Independence as traitors. Besides the Continental Congress, these Tories despised Pennsylvania's radical provincial government, which had undermined their political power by extending the vote to all tax-paying free men. Other Philadelphians, later known as neutralists, enjoyed Howe's hospitality but remained discreet, waiting to see which way the wind would blow. Howe's aide-de-camp in his dance card diplomacy was Captain John André, a handsome, charming combination of a soldier and a social secretary. André established himself in the house of Benjamin Franklin, then seeking the support of the French monarchy at Versailles. To occupy himself in his ample free time, André penned verses, acted in plays, painted watercolors, and made love to the prettiest girls in town. His favorites were the two Peggies, Peggy Chu, daughter of Benjamin Chu, and Peggy Shippen, daughter of neutralist judge Edward Shippen. Throughout the bleak winter, Howe focused on his duties as peace ambassador, making no effort to pursue his decimated enemy 20 miles away. The tall, heavy, coarse-featured general, cool and fearless in combat, was, quote, the most indolent of mortals, close quote, off the battlefield, according to American General Charles Lee. Even after spring arrived, Howe busied himself in Philadelphia with his mistress, Elizabeth Loring, wife of the Commissary General of Military Prisoners, while General Washington and Baron von Steuben rebuilt the American army at Valley Forge. In France, Benjamin Franklin noted that, quote, Philadelphia has taken Howe. In May 1778, Howe was replaced as commander-in-chief by General Sir Henry Clinton and summoned home to London to justify his lackluster performance before his critics in Parliament. Before he left, his loyal officers decided to throw him the farewell party to end all parties. 22 of them passed the tricorn hat and raised 3,312 guineas, a sum that would have supported the American army for a week. Adjusted for simple inflation, 3,312 guineas equals $577,776 today, adjusted to reflect the growth in workers' earnings since 1778. The sum jumps to $7,384,609. Either way, this purse was more than enough to underwrite an unforgettable blowout. John André took charge as artistic director, supported by a small cadre of equally aesthetic officers. Together, they planned an event called the Mischianza, sometimes spelled Mescianza, an Italian term meaning medley or miscellany. André himself crafted the invitation, a laurel-bordered cartouche, supported by cannons, flags, and other military accoutrements. While the cartouche showed a setting sun, its legend asserted, Luceo descedens, auctu splendore resurgam, or, I shine in descent, but shall rise again in greater splendor. Hundreds of invitations were sent to Philadelphia's first families, many of whom accepted with delight. Meanwhile, dozens of British soldiers were assigned to erect temporary structures at an abandoned estate south of the city. On May 18, 1778, a warm and sunny Monday, elegant carriages choked Knight's Wharf at Green Street in Northern Liberties, where the Mischianza's 400 participants boarded flatboats. At 4 p.m., three boats filled with musicians cast off from the wharf, leading an imperial waterborne procession down the Delaware. In a lavishly decorated galley behind them, General Sir William Howe sat in state, accompanied by his brother, Admiral Sir Richard Howe, his successor, General Sir Henry Clinton, his mistress, Mrs. Loring, and his retinue of officers and ladies. Two other galleys and a string of barges carried the other celebrants. Cannons boomed as British warships in the harbor hailed their commanders. Spectators filled dozens of smaller boats that bobbed among the larger vessels and packed every wharf and rooftop overlooking the Delaware. While some cheered the spectacle, others cursed the grandiose display. The regatta landed at the Association Battery at the foot of what is now Wharton Street, where it was saluted by 19 guns from two warships. a military band preceding the assemblage, led by the Howes, up the sloping lawn of Walnut Grove, country seat of the late Joseph Wharton, at current-day Wharton and Fifth Streets, two rows of towering grenadiers and light horsemen in full uniform and at stiff attention lined the path of the procession from the river to the estate. As the celebrants approached the mansion, they passed under a triumphal arch honoring Admiral Howe, decorated with naval trophies and topped by Neptune with his trident. 100 yards farther on, they passed through a second arch honoring General Howe, adorned with military trophies and surmounted by a figure of fame. Between the arches, two temporary pavilions faced each other, forming a rectangular arena for the afternoon's diversions. The first row of seats in each pavilion was reserved for the 14 ladies of the Mischianza, quote, the foremost in youth, beauty, and fashion, with 7 sitting on each side. They wore costumes designed by André in a stylized Turkish fashion popular in London, sheer robes of flowing white silk with sashes tied in a large bow and tall gauze turbans covered with feathers and pearls. The outfits of the ladies in one pavilion were trimmed in white and rose, while those in the opposite pavilion bore touches of black and orange. These ladies were the daughters of the city's most elite families, Chu, Bond, Redman, Franks, White, Smith, Craig, and, possibly, Shippen. One of the mysteries of the Mischianza is whether Peggy Shippen and her two sisters, Mary and Sarah, actually attended. Their names appear in some accounts, and one of Sarah Shippen's granddaughters insisted that her grandmother loved to recall the event. But other family chronicles assert that Edward Shippen forbade his 3 daughters from going at the last moment. While the official reason given is that he was ashamed of their flimsy costumes, it's more likely that the neutralist judge had detected a shift in the wind. Rumors were circulating that the British would soon desert Philadelphia. Once the guests were seated, a flourish of trumpets announced the ceremony of the carousel, a fairy tale joust. 7 knights on white horses rode into the enclosure. They looked like musketeers in their pink and white satin costumes, inspired by the French court of Henry IV, with baggy trousers, puffed sleeves, and plumed hats. Their herald carried a shield showing a white rose entwined with a red rose and the motto, "We droop when separated." These were the knights of the blended rose, who saluted the pink and white damsels and issued a challenge that no other ladies equaled them in wit, beauty, and every accomplishment. Among them was John André, who swore his fealty to Miss Peggy Chu. In response, 7 knights on black horses charged into the enclosure, dressed in black and orange versions of the same outfit. These were the knights of the Burning Mountain, whose herald bore a shield with an erupting volcano and the motto, "I burn forever." The black knights saluted their ladies in the opposite pavilion and accepted the challenge to defend their honor, and the tournament began. After several playful passes on horseback with lance, pistol, and sword that harmed no one, the marshal of the field declared a tie, deeming the ladies so fair and the knights so brave that it would have been impious to decide in favor of either. Evening was falling, and the Mischianza guests strolled through formal gardens to the Wharton mansion for refreshments and cards. Over one door of the gaming room stood a painting of a cornucopia filled with flowers, while over the opposite door was a second cornucopia, empty and withered. These were ominous emblems for the gambling mad British. Several officers lost everything that evening, including their military commissions, and returned to England bankrupt and disgraced. After cards, the company proceeded to the ballroom. The blue, pink, and gold walls of the vast chamber were lined with 85 tall mirrors and 34 candelabra borrowed from local residents, creating an illusion of infinite space and brilliance. The knights and their ladies opened the ball with a minuet. At 9 p.m., the music stopped, and the guests crowded around the windows to view fireworks. As cascades of light filled the sky, General Howe's triumphal arch burst into life, spouting Chinese fountains and rockets. The figure of Fame sparkled with stars, and a fiery banner emerged from her trumpet with the French motto,
Tes lauriers sont immortels.
Your laurels are immortal. Not all of the noise was produced by fireworks. Some explosions came from British cannons defending the redoubts north of the city against an attack by American commandos. For a brief moment, reality threatened to crash the party, until the British instructed their musicians to play more loudly and drown out the cannon fire. Supper was announced at midnight, when a seemingly solid wall composed of folding doors melted away to reveal a vast dining saloon, ablaze with dozens more mirrors and candelabras. Black servants in turbans and sashes greeted the celebrants with a low salaam before serving them an opulent banquet of 1,200 dishes. Refreshed by this snack, the guests returned to the ballroom and danced until dawn, when the long party finally ground to a halt. The ladies were escorted home by British officers, who retreated to coffee houses and taverns to fortify themselves for the coming day. Back at Walnut Grove, soldiers began to dismantle André's artifice and to return the mirrors and candelabras to their owners. The Miss Gianza's 14 hours of illusion were followed by a long hangover. On the evening of May 19th, General Howe led nearly 12,000 British troops to Barren Hill, northwest of the city, hoping to capture 2,200 American forces led by the Marquis de Lafayette. Thanks to advance warning and, perhaps, the party-pooped British officers, Lafayette was able to lead his troops from under the enemy's nose to safety across the Schuylkill, with only a few casualties. Howe's final attempt to secure a military victory in America had failed. 5 days later, Sir William Howe sailed for England to face his critics. The Miss Gianza, which his officers hoped would demonstrate their loyalty, was denounced by English Whigs after a narrative of the event, penned by the publicity-hungry André, appeared in London's Gentleman magazine. Despite these attacks, Howe was fully exonerated, later becoming a powerful political figure. At his death in 1814, the 5th Viscount Howe was a privy councillor to the British Crown and Governor of Plymouth. The day after Howe's departure, British officials informed Joseph Galloway, civilian superintendent general of police, that their army would leave Philadelphia within the month. France had entered the war as an American ally in February, and Clinton wanted to concentrate his forces in British-held New York. Many Tories panicked at news of the impending evacuation, fearful of partisan retribution. One witness described a continual scene of terror, hurry, and confusion, while another reported that nothing but misery and sorrow are to be seen in the town. The preoccupied Clinton was besieged by desperate loyalists, begging for protection. Meanwhile, merchants who had eagerly extended credit now pleaded for payment from British officers, who viewed settling their debts as an extremely low priority. The departing army would leave over £10,000 in unpaid bills. In early June, the Delaware River was jammed with nearly 300 ships to transport 3,000 Tory refugees to New York or London. Streets surrounding the harbor were crowded with carts and wagons filled with Loyalist possessions, most of which would be left on the wharves or dumped into the Delaware. Once the transports were loaded, they sailed 45 miles south of Philadelphia, where they sat moored for 2 weeks while Clinton prepared his troops. The immobilized ships were packed with despairing refugees, living in filthy conditions on meager rations as they waited for the signal to sail. Among them was Rebecca Franks, one of the belles of the Miss Gianza, who would marry a British officer and die in London as Lady Johnson in 1823. 1 month after the Miss Gianza, Clinton's 17,000 British troops evacuated Philadelphia. From June 15th to June 18th, flatboats ferried men, horses, artillery, wagons, and provisions across the Delaware to Cooper's Point, from whence they proceeded overland across New Jersey to New York City. John André's luggage included books, musical instruments, scientific equipment, and a portrait of Benjamin Franklin, all of which he had looted from Franklin's house. The portrait was returned in 1906 and now hangs in the White House. At the same time, the moored fleet was given its signal to disembark and transported its cargo of refugees to safety in New York or London. Less than 15 minutes after the last British left Philadelphia, on June 18th, the first American soldiers entered the ruined city. In the following days, mobs attacked a few Tories, but General Benedict Arnold, military commander of the city, limited violence by declaring martial law. Councils of safety, composed of radical patriots, seized Tory property and ordered loyalists to report for trial. The estates of 79 Philadelphians were confiscated, and over 100 were convicted of treason. Three of them were executed. The ladies of the Mischianza were not placed on trial. Some Philadelphians tried to shun or censor them for socializing with the enemy. When Washington's officers planned a ball to honor French officers who had assisted their cause, there was talk of excluding those Mischianza maidens still in Philadelphia. But their wealthy and prominent families were now officially patriots, and the girls received invitations. Of the 11 women who were definitely at the Mischianza, two, besides Rebecca Franks, moved to England. Most of the others married wealthy and prominent Americans and became members of the country's new Republican aristocracy. In 1779, Peggy Shippen married General Benedict Arnold. Peggy Chu married Colonel John Eager Howard of Maryland, although she kept a place in her heart for her Mischianza knight. Years later, Mrs. Howard told a visitor to her Baltimore home that Major Andre was a most witty and cultivated gentleman. Her husband, who had fought Howe's forces at White Plains in Monmouth, thundered, "He was a damn spy, sir, nothing but a damn spy." John Andre, the impresario of the Mischianza, did become a spy. After leaving Philadelphia, he was promoted to the rank of major and placed in charge of British secret intelligence. Tories put him in touch with Benedict Arnold, who needed money and was unhappy with his treatment by Congress. The two men plotted for Arnold, then commander of West Point, to surrender the crucial garrison to the British, giving them control of the Hudson Valley. Historians believe that Peggy Shippen Arnold knew of the conspiracy, although the extent of her involvement is uncertain. On September 23, 1780, Andre was captured by American militiamen after conferring with Benedict Arnold at West Point. When they searched him, they found documents from Arnold describing the plot. Tipped off, the Arnolds were able to escape to British-held New York. In 1782, they moved to London, where they would spend the rest of their lives while Arnold's name became an American synonym for traitor. George Washington turned down Major Andre's request for a firing squad, the proper mode of execution for an officer and a gentleman. On October 2nd, 1780, a 30-year-old spy was hanged like a common criminal in Tappan, New York, and his body buried in a plain coffin under the gallows. In 1821, the Duke of York had Andre's remains transferred to the Heroes' Corner of Westminster Abbey and placed beneath a magnificent monument depicting a sorrowful Britannia. The elderly Mrs. Benedict Arnold was a frequent visitor to his tomb. Forgotten after the Revolution, the Mischianza was reborn as a literary phenomenon in the 1800s, thanks to writers like George Lippard, Washington Irving, and S. Weir Mitchell. The earlier books, written during America's formative years, stressed British decadence and indolence versus native rectitude and self-sacrifice. But after the Civil War, attitudes towards Great Britain softened, and upper-class Americans delighted in Anglophilia. In Henry Peterson's Pemberton, 1873, the Mischianza is lauded as, quote, "the finest and most artistic entertainment in the way of a festivity that ever delighted the eyes of beautiful women and brave men in this prosaic American world," close quotes. In 1894, Sophie Howard Ward, great-granddaughter of Peggy Chu, fueled interest in the Mischianza when she published John Andre's narrative of the event in Century Illustrated magazine. The memoir, illustrated with Andre's watercolors, had been presented to Peggy Chu by her admiring knight shortly before his departure in June 1778. After publication, Ward sold the original manuscript to her cousin, Centennial Sam and Mary Johnson Chu, owners of Cliveden and parents of Sam II and Bessie. 2 years later, under the Chu's guidance, the Mischianza became an opportunity for America's elite to mingle with European nobles like the Prince of Savoy, La Comtesse de Diesbach, and the Countess Pappenheim, nay, Mary Wheeler of Philadelphia, who had purchased her husband and title with a multi-million-dollar dowry. As John André and Peggy Chu danced in Horticultural Hall, the vulgar Vanity Fair of the previous century was reborn as a celebration of gentility and elegance, where the pure-blooded aristocracies of two great nations joined hands. With one minuet, the traitors of 1778 had been transformed into the transatlantic trendsetters of 1896.
So, that's the end of the chapter. The book it is from, Wicked Philadelphia, Sin in the City of Brotherly Love by Thomas Keels, is available on Amazon.com. Please visit Tom's website, www.thomaskeels.com, for more information on his other books and upcoming talks and lectures. That's Keels, K-E-E-L-S. I'll put a link in the show notes. Tom tells me, by the way, that the Chu home in Germantown is often pronounced Cliveden, just like its namesake, the huge manor house in Buckinghamshire, England, even though the filly Cliveden is found on Cliveden Street. A little local trivia there. I'll add, just for general interest, that Major André, as it mentions in the chapter, often put on plays and participated in theatricals at the South Street or Southwark Theatre that we've talked of before, and that, in fact, he had painted scenery for them, and that scenery was in the collection of the theatre for decades thereafter and was proudly shown off for many plays presented in Philadelphia. The scenery, of course, was lost in the 1821 fire that destroyed the South Street Theatre. Tom Keels tells me, however, there is a picture of a grenadier painted by André, either as a prop for one of the plays or for the Mischianza at the Germantown Historical Society. Thanks so much for listening to this special episode. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed reading it. I'll see you again next time, when we will be bringing you the story of John Arnault, the Black Booth at the Academy of Music. Oh, it will be another thrilling adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.